usual academic that studies financial markets, that studies the real world. She is someone that belongs to the real world. She comes from financial markets and brings to us her experience, her knowledge, her insights today. Let me tell you a little bit about her background. She started her career as a journalist at the Washington Post. She studied in the US. She has a BA in political science, an MA in law and diplomacy. She has spent 16 years of her career in asset management, in investment management. She was managing director at Goldman Sachs Asset Management. She led the emerging markets portfolio managing team at PIMCO. And then, since a couple of years ago, she has taken on roles as non-executive board member, board director in different companies. She is, for example, non-executive director of Alrosa and of the Moscow Stock Exchange. She's also a member of the investment committee of the Enterprise Development Program at Oxfam, UK, and she's a member of the Council of the Girls' Day School Trust. Now, before we start with her presentation, let me tell you a little bit about, or let me share with you some information about something else that relates to her personal passions in life. She has just established the women's record for completing the Explorers Grand Slam in less than 8 months. If you are not familiar with the Explorers Grand Slam, that means she has climbed the seven summits, the highest mountains in the seven continents, including trekking on skis to the North Pole and the South Pole. So hopefully she will be able to tell us a little bit about this during her presentation. Now, her presentation today is focused on practical and behavioral elements of investment, and the title is The Search for Outperformance in Investment, Process versus Brilliance. Please join me in welcoming Masha Gordon.
Thank you, Michaela. Is my mic on? Yeah. Okay. So today we'll talk about markets and why markets are sometimes less efficient than the theory will suggest. I'm sure you guys have taken, or some of you have taken finance classes or economics classes, and we tend to learn the formulaic approach to calculating cost of capital, and we think that markets very quickly arbitrage away all the excess profits. And again, we tend to think that markets are efficient and rational. But hopefully in your life, and you guys are millennials, you've had some experience, I guess, through the markets of 2008 and most recently through, I guess, the Brexit. You see how emotional markets get. And we get puzzled, right? We get puzzled why do such dislocations as we've seen in 2008 occur? Haven't people thought about the subprime mortgages being dangerous or toxic? Why did it take so long, and why do the drawdowns, or why do the negative returns in the market, why are they so severe? The answer lies in the field of behavioral finance. And though I'm not an academic, as a practitioner, I found throughout my career that understanding the tenets of behavioral finance, understanding the tenets, how we make decisions, and how we humans are the worst enemies of ourselves, helped me very much in trying to avoid, and again, I would say trying to avoid, I'm a human with clearly fear and other factors that affect our rational decision-making, and helped me, in fact, in my recent mountaineering challenge when I had to climb a mountain like Everest in trying to make good decisions. Again, cognizance of the pitfalls of decision-making. Hopefully, even if you're not interested in asset management, you will take some of the behavioral traps, and we'll talk about those, away when you think about taking decisions and ask yourself a question, what could be wrong here? So the title of the lecture is The Search for Outperformance, Process versus Brilliance. Let me ask you a question. What do you think these people have in common? Do you guys recognize? I know that the portraits are somewhat small, but this is George Soros, Warren Buffett, Bill Gross, Mr. Templeton, any idea what they have in common? Anyone wants to volunteer? Okay, I understand there's hundreds of people. So what they have in common is they live to tell the tale. They were able to play the long game. They're all, as you can see here, quite tenured. Soros, I think, is in his 80s. Mr. Buffett is well into his 80s. Bill Gross is 70-plus years old. All of them were managers of the decade. What they have in common is their ability that they've demonstrated throughout their career to play the long game and to tame a human within themselves. I have worked, actually, with one of them quite closely, with Bill Gross, and I can tell you that this is the gentleman that can make 180-degree turns on his decision without feeling embarrassed about it. One has to be somewhat, maybe autistic is not the right word, but somewhat uncaring about what people think. And he recently demonstrated that in kind of a PR blow-up of his firm and his image. But that helped him, ironically, to be a brilliant investor. So today's topic is the spotlight on neurofinance. It's a field that covers the behavioral finance, on human culpability. And this is beautiful because we are emotional, and that's why we love, that's why we're passionate, but also it's very, very dangerous in decision-making. Investing as a probabilistic exercise, and games that are worth playing. We'll talk about where do we have where do we stand a chance of winning the game, and the importance and hallmark of a strong process. Process is what capped this people. Investment process is the framework that kept these people in the game. And again, we'll talk about the hallmark of that process. So is it luck? Is it process? Is it brilliance? Is it that Bill Gross was waking up every day and knew how Federal Reserve will move the rates? No. Bill had a process, and actually a lot of his calls were based on picking up, as he was referencing, $10 bills. He had a lot of structural trades where he knew that there was very, very high chance of winning every time because there was a market inefficiency. It wasn't getting the big macro calls right. In fact, if you look at the managers that blew up spectacularly, these were the guys that got something right. For example, there's a hedge fund manager called Paulson. He got the subprime right, but then, so the people gave him a ton of money. He raised billions and billions of dollars in his funds, and he made bets on other things which he understood less well, such as gold, and he blew up spectacularly in those. So it's very important to remain humble as an investor. It's very important to remain humble as a mountaineer in front of big nature, understanding that some of your best wins may have been entirely due to luck and not because of your brilliance. So Benjamin Graham, the father of the value investing, once said that investor's chief problem, even if his worst enemy, is likely to be himself. So let's look at the brain. So we have primary cortex, and we have pleasure center there called amygdala. And this is amazing because now neuroscience allows us to make experiments on the brain of a trader and a gambler. And you see here the pleasure centers of the amygdala activated. And it's the same pleasure centers with the trader and the gambler. Gambler, you would say someone who is reckless, right? Activated when they're making a bet. So we experience incredible rush, hormonal rush, when we make a bet. You probably have bet in a casino or in a lottery. And when we expect to win, and when it goes our way, again, we think it's brilliant, we've been brilliant. But in fact, we are batting, and we are being under influence of substance, which is that hormone that activates amygdala. So if you look at the battle of the brains, trader versus gambler, gambler is led by his emotions. He is excited. He's excitable. He gets disproportionate amount of pleasure from gain and then incredible low from loss. He wants excitement. That's why he gambles. He acts randomly. So he won't be betting, say, on the same thing over and over and over again. He may be betting, on different probabilities. Because if you were betting on the same thing over and over and over again, your probability of actually getting it right over time rises. He has no risk management, and he believes in luck. Traders were the guys who I showed you, portraits of who I showed you before, who live to tell the tale. They think in probabilities. They think in odds. They're disciplined. They cut their losses. They're prepared. And they trade. They treat trade in this business. And again, I would never forget how, having been a fund manager, joining Bill Gross's firm, I have seen him make 180-degree turns on decisions in front of people. And you think, oh, my God. Like, I understood how hard it was, must have been. Someone who was on his perch at CNBC every day talking about the Fed going a certain way, then just changing his portfolios, and then being able to admit in front of everyone without experiencing shame that he was wrong. So trading is business, and someone who has an edge. And being able to articulate what your edge is, again, is very important, because that's the only place where you would probably be able to make money in more times than not. So what are the behavioral traps and the blind spots? One is overconfidence. So when we, I don't know if you guys took accounting class or whether you have ever modeled a company, but if you take a typical analyst on Wall Street, they will model a company in a straight line. I manage people, I've been an analyst, I've done the same. When we think about future, we think of something as the distribution on a continuum. Future, unfortunately, doesn't look that way. In fact, I will show you the chart on returns of S&P and the difference between the normal distribution of returns, i.e. expected distribution of returns, and what had actually happened, and the differential is huge. So, but still, we have this confidence that we know what we're doing. So again, forecasting range as a result tends to be too narrow. This is why we had the internet bubble in 2001. This is why we're probably having an internet bubble now, because again, we don't tend to think that the outcomes could be very, very different or very random or very large. The other one is confirmation bias. What does it mean? It devalues negative information. So let's say you're an analyst and you're making a bet, or you're an investor, you're making a bet on a company. You make investment case, you pitch to your boss, or you buy the stock, and you tend to have a vision of the future. And then that future becomes present, and it starts conflicting with your vision. So what does a human do? The human typically then overweighs the facts that go with your investment thesis. This company is great and the management is fantastic, but let's say, oh gosh, they had a quarterly loss. Boy, oh, it's a one-off, or it's something external or exogenous, or it's the markets. So we tend to, unfortunately, because we're humans, because we have emotions, because we're vested, because we may have made a very public bet, we tend to devalue negative information and stick to one picture. The other one is anchoring. So we tend to anchor on a certain price. So let's say if you bought something at like a stock at $5 per share, and then that stock falls, you're anchoring still the notion of what the company's worth based on what you paid. And in fact, the company may be worth a lot less because, again, the future vision became present, and that present may have not been right. Framing effect. We tend to sell winners and keep the losers. Why? Because it's always more difficult for us to admit we've been wrong. And again, those guys who lived to tell the tale, they were able to battle all of these trends by effectively bagging the gains and or keeping the gains, or being long-term investors and cutting the losers, saying, I've been wrong. So ability in any decision-making, whether you're a politician, whether you're an alpinist, or whether you're an investor, to say, I am wrong, I should turn around, is invaluable. But you probably have experienced that yourself in life, having made a lot of decisions. It's a very, very, very difficult thing to do, particularly when your decision is public. And this is why, because of a number of these factors, and hopefully you can now see the broader picture, we have less efficient markets, or we have markets that lag, because there are many humans that have careers, that have families, that have mortgages, that have pride. Those guys may not be able to admit, I am wrong, and effectively do the things that would otherwise be considered irrational. Comfort of consensus, or the group effect, or groupthink. Why do you think tragedies happen on mountains? Tragedies happened on mountains like K2, for example, because you have one guy deciding, weather is the key parameter. Just think of weather as the markets or the Fed. So the Fed can carry you out. You know, bad weather day or storm can carry you out. One guy decides it's a good day. He goes out. Someone says, well, have you seen Paul? He's up. He's going. He's seizing the moment. And weather windows tend to be very, very narrow. And the second one joins. And then the third one joins. And the same happens in with trades and trading the market, right? And then weather turns and they never come back. It's amazing to see the reports that get produced by what is called prime brokerages, those guys who deal with the hedge funds are their clients. They are able without, actually they are able with giving the names of their clients to publish the holdings of the funds. As certain funds are weather bell funds, right? They are what, you know, the actors who people watch. Oh, have you seen Tudor has bought the stock? Oh, well, let's all pile into positions. So that group, you know, to be honest, for Tudor, this could have been one out of 100 positions. And if he got 51 of his positions right and 49 wrong, and that one was in the 49, you know, he won, you lost. But that group thing and the crowd thing is, again, very, very difficult. And social conformity. Clearly being out on the perch in 2006 saying that, hey, subprime, this U.S. Housing bubble, it's frankly a bubble. You should be shorting it. The problem is, if you're shorting something, you have a very, very finite amount of money because you have to put up the margins for your losses, and losses in shorting, obviously, infinite. If you're early, and lots of people are early, and that's why it's important to understand that these inefficiencies go for a long time, you could be carried out. So again, social conformity, inefficiency kind of prevents the remedy of these trades over some time. So how do people like Buffett, people like Gross, how do they tame a human in themselves? So I'm going to read a few quotes, and that hopefully will give you a sense of how the process is one of the very, very few ways to square that and to remain in the game for a long time. So Buffett said, face up to two unpleasant facts. The future is never clear, and you pay a very high price in the stock market for a cheery consensus. Uncertainty is your friend, because it is a friend of the buyer of long-term values. Inactivity strikes us as intelligent behavior. And then he says, lethargy, bordering on sloth, remains the cornerstone of our investment style. What is he talking about? He's talking about, you know, those who try to check their portfolio every day for losses and gains are going to get screwed because they will experience the bounce of despair and euphoria. They will be selling their winners, and they will be keeping their losers. And that's why he says lethargy bordering on sloth. Buffett is known for very, very rarely, almost never selling the companies he owns. He makes, he takes a lot of time. And he has a process in his brain. Unfortunately, he is a one-person kind of firm. In getting his portfolio right, he has his tenants. He needs to understand the company using five fingers, right, not complicated spreadsheets. He never listens to others. He takes decisions himself. But again, he keeps those companies forever because values compound. So for him, This is the process, and again, if you are able to sit through, not bring up a human, sit through the full investment cycle, not bring a human in yourself often, you are likely to be a winner. So let's think about what investing is. Investing is a probabilistic exercise. So expected value is one of the terms you may have heard. Let's kind of go over that. What is the range of probability? So you can think about stock returns in the future as the continuum of outcomes. Let's say a company makes widgets. It enters a high growth market. It's worth five times in 5 years' time, you know, what it's worth today. It, let's say, has a fraud case against it, you know, it loses a patent, and it's worth suddenly a fraction of what it used to be worth. Both events are theoretically possible. So when you think about what the stock is worth, the stock is not worth the best outcome you can imagine. The stock is worth the probability weighted sum of odds times the outcomes, right? Probability weighted set of values. Again, sounds basic, but I manage money in the emerging markets throughout my career, seeing the insanity in valuations and being a part of that insanity in some cases, in places like China, where people thought, gosh, you know, this company should be worth, the government will continue printing money, the growth of nominal growth of 15% will go all forever. And again, using that straight line forecasting, the values that investors were assigning for companies were extraordinary. And again, it was because investors were young, investors were untested and had little understanding. I mean, you're sitting here in the School of Economics and Politics, so you understand the way that the factors of policymaking have on the economic growth and companies' performance. But again, assuming that you know, everyone in China will own that diaper, or you know, there will be never competition, margins will you know, go into stratosphere, leverage, operating leverage could be only positive and never negative. You know, this is the reason why we go through stock bubbles. So Buffett says, take the probability of loss times the amount of possible loss from the probability of gain times the amount of possible gain. That is what we're trying to do. It's imperfect, but that's what it's all about. So next time you're thinking of buying a stock, again, don't think just about the great case that someone made for you, that this is the best internet company forever. Again, think of all these grand, you know, applications that you guys love, right? Twitter, LinkedIn, et cetera, that were put in the market on such extraordinary valuation, and why are they worth a fraction today? Again, it's because competition inevitably comes. Rotation of leaders is huge. If you take S&P 500, for example, the index in 1960s and the index today, the overlap will be just 20%. Why is that, right? It's because the industries evolve, right? And profit pools change. So again, invest in, you need to think about probabilities. How do you skew odds to your favor, right? Because that's the only way how we can make money consistently. It's thinking that asset prices or stocks or bonds, they reflect a set of expectations. We need to understand what the expectations are because they are analogous to odds. Understanding market expectations is at least as important as, and often different as, the fundamental knowledge. So it's all good to know that this is a fabulous service provider that everyone in my class is using. What you need to understand as well is, what do investors think? Do they also think it's a fabulous application that has infinite growth? And are these expectations embedded in the stock price? If they are, you have no business of owning that company unless it is unless you have a very, very different set of you know, growth assumptions for terminal value. You're probably better off thinking about companies where your perception either of the loss of value is better or is different from the market. So focusing on where you're different, either in the distribution or in the delta of the value, is where and how we can skew those odds in our favor. So the goal of our investment process is to find mispricings and attractive asymmetries. And it's very, very important to distinguish between your knowledge of fundamentals and expectations implied by the price. That's, over the long term, the only way to make money. So looking for price asymmetries. This is the guy who wrote a book on betting, Bet with the Best. The issue is not which horse in the race is most likely winner, but which horse of horses are often offering odds that exceed their actual chances of victory. Sounds obvious to you now, right? This may sound elementary, and many players may think that they are following these principles, but very few actually do. Under this mindset, everything but the odds fades from the view. There is no such thing as liking a horse, or liking the name of a horse, to win a race. Only an attractive discrepancy between his chances and his price. So this is the chart I referred to. So this, if you study statistics, it's a normal distribution. Standard deviations, right? So majority of outcomes will be here, and there will be some outliers. This is S&P 500 daily returns between 1977 and 2005. No reason for the time period. I just found the data. This is the same, except that it's frequency difference, normal versus actual daily returns. And you see that, look at the tails. These are the outliers. They're much fatter that they're here. Here you should have had this amount of occurrences. Here is how many times they occurred and how deep were the drawdowns. So again, shows you that reality with its black swan events, with larger market movements, demonstrate to you that markets are emotional and that these outcomes are unequally distributed. So where forecasts go wrong, it's the black swan events, right? And black swans, again, is where it dawns on everyone and then everyone flocks together that, in fact, reality was different from the predicted future. And you can see how this comes together in odds versus outcomes. So in the first table, you see good probability, bad expected value. It's the same odds, right? 70-30. But if your outcome, if the bad outcome is 70%, clearly your if the outlier value, a minority, but it's big, it outweighs the fact that you've had a good percentage of value attributed to positive outcome. Here it's the other way around, and you see that the beta value is higher. So bad probability, good expected value. So here you would have been probably wise for you to bet on this outcome because the market was betting on this company doing poorly. But because of the outcome times the odds, you know, you probably would have made money because the market would have valued this probability is very different. You probably would have had to pay very few cents on a dollar for this bet and quite a bit for this. So focus on process versus outcomes. Never confuse the two. And here are quite colorful descriptions. So you have good outcome and a good process. It's deserved success. You have a good process, bad outcome. You have a bad break. So never be embarrassed. And we'll talk about that, like how do you deal with when it goes against you, but you followed the process, you followed your rules. But if you have a bad process, i.e. you're just betting randomly, you have a good outcome, it's dumb luck. And I referenced Mr. Paulson with that. And when you have bad process and bad luck, it's poetic justice, right? You deserved it. So what is the process? What are the hallmarks of individual individual performance. So how do we put this in practice? So develop, when we say an economic process, develop a simple process of assessing odds and valuing outcomes. Focus on process versus outcomes. Recognize that even greatest investors will be wrong some 45% of the time. I should have asked you and not shown you this number. What do you think are the number of good stock calls in Buffett's portfolio? Probably not 99%. It's probably, I would reckon, 55 to 60% at any given point in time. But because of his discipline, because of the bet making, because of his time horizon, he is able to ride and come out on top. What you need to control is you need to control the downside or the amount of the quality of dogs that you have in the portfolio. And provided you win or you win at least 51% of the time, you're likely to have a positive return. Try to skew odds in your favor by choosing the right game and focus on asymmetry. So don't play a game everyone is playing, buying internet stocks at the time when they're very hot. Because the odds are that everyone knows that already, that the terminal growth rate implied by those very exciting companies is already in the price. But focusing, and you know, a lot of these guys are value investors. They are focusing on the stocks that were out of favor or on the fat calls that may not have been right. And by putting money in back in, buying cheap asset with the odds that were miscalculated, and for that reason they were cheap, they won a lot of the time. And understand the role of time. People win by holding assets for a long time and not checking portfolios. Some of the best investments have been tobacco companies. Why? Or consumer companies. Because people assume that tobacco companies will be eradicated over time, and I empathize with the emotional side, but these companies tend to have pretty sticky growth. And again, they reinvest their dividends. They pay the dividends as well. They don't
engage in reckless behavior, and over time, the compounding of the returns is enormous. The same way there is an inefficiency, for example, of valuing staple companies like Nestle or Unilever. Again, people assume that the margins on these products will erode quite dramatically, or the market implies dramatically over time. But again, these companies tend to own brands, and they tend to be market leaders, so they can continue investing, and they stay in the game. And if you look at, again, the compounding of returns of the Nestles, of Colgates of this world, they are extraordinary. So betting often on boring stocks where kind of investors are unwilling to pay high multiple, high PE ratio, because they assume that these people or these firms won't be around, they are not trendy, is actually wrong, because the trendy stocks, again, tend not to have proven enough business model, or tend to be valued so fully that the returns don't compound nicely. So what games are worth playing? Positive correlation between opportunity and dispersion of funds returns. Where do we think diversity breakdowns occur? Why do the markets get out of sync? It's institutions versus individuals. Unfortunately, institutions do a lot of things, and by institutions we mean asset management firms. They get emotional as well, and they tend to, not accept playing with certain set of instruments because the clients decided they didn't want to do that. And this, again, these breakdowns of decision-making, or rational decision-making, that's what diversity breakdown is, occur when the institutions are get constrained by parameters that they shouldn't get constrained on, that are not rational. Individuals, where does rational thinking break down is obviously when people flee with panic. I mean, you've seen obviously UK investors, or what happened in this country, right, in the past week. Pound gets dumped, and clearly we think about horrific negative things that come from Brexit, and again, emotionally, I align with that. I want to stay in the EU, but again, would it be that bad? Would cheaper currency actually do we think about the cheap currency bringing our export revenues and current account, helping the current account surplus? Should the currency be that emotional, and the developed market currency, adjusting 10% in a couple of days, period is quite interesting. Non-fundamental selling, when people need to sell for reasons other than the change in value. Why does it happen? Again, people need to raise cash. They may have clearly, like you've seen in 2008, why did the liquidity markets or credit markets seize? They seized because you had withdrawals from certain funds that you needed to satisfy, and you needed to sell instruments that may not have should have had that collateral damage coming through. And when you start having liquidity squeeze, again, that type of non-fundamental selling could turn into panic and contagion and start then affecting quality. Permanent capital. So what is permanent capital? If you look at sovereign wealth funds, for example, Norwegian fund, that has done very, very well over time. Why they have done well is because they were able to play that the time dimension of investing. They are under no obligation to pay out the money to a Norwegian population tomorrow, and as a result, they can take longer-term bets. Now let's go and talk about the $10 bills that Bill Gross have picked up. So he is an amazing investor. He truly has beat 96% of his competitors over the last 15 years. And over a longer period of time, like, he's the only man standing. So he gave this great lecture before he self-destroyed himself and moved to Janus out of PIMCO. And the lecture was at the Morningstar conference. I was there in Chicago. And he kind of opened, as he said, the hood of his car and said, I'm gonna tell you all the secrets. I didn't know, he said, how the Fed will move. I didn't make my money on making the calls on the direction of interest rates. I got this sometimes right, sometimes wrong. And I controlled them out of risk. I allocated to that type of directional decision because it's binary. He said, I have three sources of structural alpha. Alpha is the outperformance. And for the bond funds to outperform by 1% a year, is a lot because it's a low volatility asset. So he said, I was, and again, for you, it may sound like Greek, so I apologize for that. I'll try to explain. I was selling volatility, and by selling volatility, he meant I was writing insurance. So those people who don't want to leave volatility of returns, I was structuring instruments because I knew that the reason why people buy insurance, and he argued one should never buy insurance, is because of fear factor. So he was selling volatility. In financial markets, you can do it by selling VIX. This is the index that often gets used to ensure returns. Capitalizing on yield curve roll. So often you can effectively, people don't like buying long-term bonds because of, again, the duration in the bonds tend to bring a lot of volatility of returns. So he was selling shorter maturities and keeping the long maturity. And again, he was betting on that spread. Again, this spoke to the institutional dimension, how, again, investors don't like experiencing volatility of returns. But he said, I know this is a long-term inefficiency. And then he was taking treasury swaps, and effectively he was swapping the returns and treasury on returns on the corporate. And again, it sounds like Greek. I apologize. I was trying to keep it generic. But what I'm trying to demonstrate here is that the guy had three rules of how he made money, and he had those trades structurally on at any point in time, every point in time. He didn't say, like, oh, I don't think this trade is working. He kept putting these bets on because incrementally they wouldn't have destroyed his performance. But time and time and time again, he was betting on the thing that, you know, he's proven over 40 years he's been a manager. You know, those small bills, and again, neither of those trades would bring you the magnitude of returns that maybe a bet on interest rates or an opposite bet on interest rate move would give you. He was making small bets across the thing. What you may understand maybe a little bit better is in the equity world, as you know, when we have IPOs, initial public offerings of stocks, they're hot and they tend to go up, particularly in the internet arena, 80%, you know, on the first day, 100% the first day, they make headlines, people go crazy. He had a rule, and for his funds, it was kind of funny. He ran half a $1 trillion fund, right, huge fund, and he'd be going for these silly IPOs in China and selling them in the first half an hour. And, you know, we would smile and say, like, Bill, why are you doing this? He said, well, I know it's an inefficiency. I know that 80% of IPOs basically go negative within the first, let's say, month of performance. And almost 100% of IPOs give positive returns in the first half an hour. So I'm not going to be emotional sitting there thinking, does this dog food company make sense? I have this as a rule because I know probabilistically I'm going to make money. So he had a lot of small trades in his portfolio, little bells and whistles where, you know, again, you would say, like, Bill, why would you, you know, you made, let's say, $1 million gain on this trade, and for you guys it sounds a lot. For his one, just think, half a $1 trillion portfolio, this is nothing, right, in percentage terms. But he'd say, well, you know, it's like 10 pence, you know, or 10 cents lying on the ground. Why wouldn't I pick it up? So process, i.e. he followed those rules, and he had those trades at any point in time, gave him outperformance. It weren't the big calls where he was trying to get both the odds and the outcomes right. And, you know, if he had clearly a big conviction on big calls, he would put these bets on, but he would not allow the magnitude of those bets to get out of hand, and he would also not allow if he was losing money in a particular call, to allow himself to be human. He would turn around his decision-making 180 degrees. So again, taming the human and overemphasizing over outcome. So I was in the industry, which is now, you may know, you may not know, is under huge attack. And it's a huge, it was an active management industry, right? People buying mutual funds, kind of your generation of savers when you become savers, hopefully not too distant future. You guys are much more rational. You look at costs. And in the era of low returns, and as you guys know, Federal Reserve has been keeping the funds near zero, so all the asset returns tend to be low in this type of era of low growth and low interest rates. You know, you look at costs, and the industry that I was a part of, and I, you know, benefited to being a part of, is now experiencing huge outflows from active fund management, where you would have been willing to pay, I guess in the 90s, 1% of assets under management as a fee to a very, very smart fund manager. By the way, 80% of fund managers underperform the benchmark, right? So again, the odds are not in your favor of hiring active. But you know, in this era of low returns, huge amount of people are switching to passive. So in order to remain, if any of you are sick in career in active management, think twice, because the industry will have to shrink. This is an industry that had margins of, I don't know, in some houses, 80% plus, and PIMCO was, I think, 90% operating margin. This industry will have to slash fees and will have to move. So who stays in the game? So we have a whole other little cottage industry called consultants. And they come to assess a process of a manager. So what do they look at? They look at repeatability of performance. And what they want to know is, how do you make money? They ask you a precisely question, what's your investment philosophy? What's your process? But they want to see, actually, how do you articulate what you do, and does this tie in with your process? So if you're saying that you are a value investor and they find a lot of growth stocks in your portfolio, they'll understand that you're betting in a very random fashion, that you are not consistently exercising the discipline of buying the out-of-favor odds, and that's what you could think about as value investing. Does your team do what they say they do? Is it stable? It's effectively, unfortunately, a talent management business. So if you have a team and it doesn't stay together for 10 years, your odds of taking right decisions and remaining an outperformer are quite low. Does historical performance validate description of your process? Again, if you said you make money when value outperforms, but your fund outperformed at the time when value factor didn't, like in the internet bubble, you probably are not doing what you're saying you're doing. And again, consultants understand and know that the only fair chance we have in the market populated with human beings and intermediated by human beings is the process. That implies that there will be a number of years that you as a value manager may underperform, because there will be periods when madness takes over markets, like 2000 and beginning of 2001. And you have to have an extraordinary power of self-confidence and extraordinary power of, again, ability to stick with your bets, like Mr. Templeton, John Templeton, that I showed you on the picture. He ran a fund, huge firm, global equity firm, that from 1999 until 2001 was horribly underperforming. And clearly, you know, he faced withdrawals from clients, he faced criticism, but he stuck to his bets, because he said, I know that I am paying so little now for these companies when the other companies in the market demand extraordinary value. So again, it's very tough to have that staying power with your clients, but that's the hallmark of a great process. And they look at for giveaways of poor process, and that's portfolio turnover. So when people change their minds all the time, reassessing decisions, you know that they are probably, you know, doing funny stuff like keeping their dogs, harnessing their winners, and probably their ability, i.e. not harnessing that continuum of time that tends to help with performance. They also ask who disagrees with the leader. Because it's decision-making, you need to have healthy debate in order to avoid the traps that we spoke about, which were overconfidence, groupthink, you know, the confirmation bias. And, you know, does the culture tolerate investment debate? So lastly, I will finish in 5 minutes. Ray Dalio runs a great firm on the East Coast, and he wrote this book. If you're interested in decision-making, you should read his kind of a folk character, great investor. He runs Bridgewater, one of the most formidable hedge funds that has been around for 30 years. So here he has this folksy principles that he published. And he says, and he posits, that there is a giant, there's giant untapped potential in disagreement, especially if disagreement is between two or more thoughtful people. While individuals operating individually can choose whatever values and principles they like, when working in a group, the people must agree on the group's values and principles. If the group is not clear about them, confusion and eventually gravitation towards population averages will result. And as we said, this doesn't tend to produce results. People who confuse what they wish were true with what is really true create distorted pictures of reality. that make it impossible for them to make the best choices. So again, the great hallmark of a process is an ability to disagree. I, you know, have had experience. I've had a very stable career, right? I worked for Goldman's for 12 years and then PIMCO for 4 years. And for me, it was very interesting to compare the investment culture of the two firms. Goldman is an amazing firm, despite of PR flack that may have received in the past, I guess in 2008, 2009. It's a firm with very strong culture, and the testament of the greatness of the firm is the fact that it's one of the very few banks that survived since the 19th century. But it's also a culture where consensus is very important because it was an investment bank. It's teamwork, et cetera. So when you have an asset management division within that complex, and you have people having, you know, as a hallmark of process is disagreement, it just doesn't work because you're meant to agree. You're meant not to be confrontational. Comparing that to PIMCO, which was run obviously by an amazing investor, but an investor who loved the argument, that firm produced extraordinary investment results. That firm produced extraordinary investment results because of that almost aggressive culture ingrained by Gross, because he questioned in an incredibly aggressive way and called you names. But, you know, this was his genius of being able to institute that culture of hunting for the truth. That culture, you know, has manifested itself in returns that were truly remarkable and stood out. So when you guys think about, you know, if you ever go to work for an investment management firm, ask yourself a question. Is there culture of debate? Because that's, to me, the key to being able to predict investment performance going forward. So conclusion, again, my experience shows or taught me that consistent process wins hands down over a handful of brilliant directional calls. And yes, every year in the market, there are brilliant guys that got a call of that year right. And there will be guys, I'm sure, that in the next few months will hear they made a killing on shorting the pound and they were so Brexit, because the odds were completely the other way, right? So they got something right, but I wouldn't be giving these guys money to make a call next year, right? Because just on the sole, basis of them getting Brexit call right, because I don't know, do they have that process or was it a sheer luck? So focus on process versus the outcomes. Understand what tilt odds to your favor. Understand the role of time, that with time, again, you are probably, if you are patient enough, and if your investment thesis is proven right, you will make money. Choose the game with asymmetries of skills, where you think you have an edge. Or join, become a founder of an organization that has strong culture of disagreement, culture of debate, and that, you know, culture also has the hallmarks of the strong process. So this is kind of my two cents on why markets are less efficient and why, again, as humans, we undermine that thesis and the beauty of an equation. We often wish we had an equation like that and it worked, but it doesn't. And again, the worst enemy of the market is a human, and the worst enemy of ourselves is, you know, our primary brain. In any decision-making, in any risky situation, be that, you know, nature, politics, or the markets. So I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Masha, for sharing your experience, your insights, and giving us advice. Also for those of us who are studying or planning to join in the future the asset management industry. Now we have some time for some questions, so I welcome all of you to ask Masha any questions you might have on her experience, on what she talked about, on something else, whatever you like. Any questions? Yeah.
Hi, my name is Katalin, and I would like to ask you, what's your opinion about the recent development in fintech, and how would that change the investment management or the asset management market? Thank you.
Well, it's an excellent question because it demonstrates the point of how unstable industry profit pools are. Profit pool is the aggregate amount of profits a certain industry is able to lock, right? And profit pools move between, let's say, providers and clients and savers, right? So we have right now very, very strong regulatory forces that favor the saver. FCA in this country, SEC in the United States, is vigilant and is very, very determined in cutting out practices that, you know, in the past allowed asset management firms to remain super profitable. And creating, you know, they do create deregulation by allowing certain segments of the market that may have been in the past closed to smaller providers or to technology-geared firms to enter the market, right? So just think how electronic, like the analogy would be the electronic banking, how in the past we would have never probably given our savings or deposit to a firm that doesn't have a brick-and-mortar office, and now we do. And what does, how can that type of player come in and, you know, help us, you know, what does it do to the profit pool of the banks? You know, they clearly cut the prices and compete on prices. So when you think about what fintech could do for the firms that have not adjusted, you know, it could basically erode the fees through, you know, for example, Franklin Templeton, the guy who was on the left, they ran an amazing global equity franchise, and they've just cut the fees on their products from 0.7% to basically 0.4%. They had terrific performance. Why did they do that? Because they understood that they could get disintermediated by a smaller firm offering passive funds and pitching the value of the price. So I think we have very, very powerful regulatory forces, plus the fact that you guys, you know, buy products in a very, very different way. And if the regulator joins with innovation on the bandwagon of allowing the innovators to offer services that they couldn't in the past, and let's say doesn't establish draconian capital requirements that rise the bar for the industry entry, that clearly poses a huge threat for the industry that in the past, to be honest, rode the point of super returns.
Another question over there.
What have you found most surprising in your career?
That's a great question. How long bubbles last? How people get penalized for being contrarian? Because you need to have and I'll tell you a story. You need to have both your staying power and your client's power. You don't manage your own money. So I managed an emerging markets fund in 2007. And I was young. I was 33, I think, whatever. Not young for you, but it was kind of a big coup to manage a big fund. And I just bagged one of my first clients at the time. It was a German manufacturer. It was his pension fund, their pension fund. And they entered the emerging markets. And if you think about the trajectory of returns, 2007 was kind of the last really big peak. China was, you know, people were paying some crazy, you know, price-to-earnings ratios for really boring firms. And if you're managing money against the benchmark, you either have to replicate the benchmark, and then if you don't have difference against the benchmark, you're not going to underperform, right? So this closet indexers. Or you make bets, and you don't own certain firms. So I was I'm a value investor. I didn't own a number of this crazy, like, you know, sort of valued companies. I underperformed that year horribly, like 700 basis points, 7% against the benchmark. But, you know, I had a very good explanation why that happened. I didn't own China Mobile, which is a boring telecom company, which is now languishing, trading at 45 times price-to-earnings ratio. This type of company should trade and now trades at maybe 12 times PE max because it's, you know, a company that is an incumbent probably, where the profit pool will be competed away. And despite of this underperformance, the German client received 30% absolute performance. And I got fired, meaning as a mandate, not as a managing director of Goldman Sachs, right? I got fired by the client after 12 months of managing money for him, and I couldn't get it. You know, like you guys are super prudent. I'm explaining to you that I don't own. It's not that there is some mystery or I lost money on bankruptcies.
I lost money, relative money, because I didn't own silly stocks that then went down, right? In 2008, all the stocks blew up spectacularly, but they wouldn't hear. So I think everyone thinks they are long-term. When they experience in the near-term experience of negative value, right, they worry about their own careers, and they think, gosh, you know, some guy who was probably picking managers or responsible for picking managers there thought, I'm going to get fired because she has underperformed, and they won't understand what she just told me. I understand, but they won't understand this. So let me just kind of say she was wrong. So it's this short-termism and how long, again, this period's last.
Hi. So, with currently we face very low returns, and as you said, passive funds are more in demand right now. So, is it the demise of active funds, and like, what's the benchmark for these funds now? And PIMCO's the total year fund, the total return on the fund last 4 years when gross was there, out of that the 3 years was negative. So, like, we are facing really, really low returns from very actively well managed funds.
Yeah, so personally, when I invest my own money, I buy only passive funds. And you could say I spent 16 years having a career of active funds. Why do I do this? I don't have an edge in picking managers. I'm not a consultant who comes in the office and can assess or has a strong... I know a few managers, and obviously I have investments in a couple of, let's say, private funds, PIMCO managers, where they've done very well, where I know that... Let's say Dan Iveson, who is now Chief Investment Officer, is a brilliant investor in less liquid markets. But unless you know that, the trade-off of potential outperformance that may come versus the odds that an average investor in the market underperforms, it's just not, I don't have the edge, right? So if you then compound negative returns, relative returns against the market, right, that an average manager produces, I just told you 80% of active managers underperform the market, with the fees that are extraordinary. And when you look at the fees, think that in the past, and the regulator is now going after that, in the past, you also, apart from that 1% fee or whatever you pay as a retail guy, you also pay the fund's expenses. So these guys really have a sweet deal. They make you pay for the research, legal expenses, custody, et cetera, right? Regulator now forces these fund managers now to pay for research and be very, very clear what's the total expense ratio. So if you're buying actively managed product, look at total expense ratio, because that's what will indicate you how much more they have to outperform the market before you start making money. I think PIMCO is going through a generational transition. It has extraordinary investment culture, and I have no doubt that that firm will rise again. But whenever you have one guy leaving, and that guy, he reigned by fear, I tell you. Like no one, like women would wear no heels on the trading floor, because he could not be disturbed. He walked in, like there were no, you know, mobile phones. He just reigned everything from culture to everything else. But he, because of that fear, people worked 16-hour days. They brought the best ideas to him. And he was, as I said, an artistic genius. He could kind of say, block out what people thought about him and make rational bets. This is extraordinary, right? It's on the spectrum, right? So when you go from that spectrum to a more normal firm, you need to figure out how do you structure the process to eliminate those behavioral issues that are likely to cloud your decision making. The interesting thing, for example, to talk about big bets. So we had this great process, and they have this great process of secular and cyclical forums, where you'd get in the room, the brightest guys, right? And they would be sitting around the table debating every quarter what is the outlook for growth. And at the end of the day, if you made bets on the basis of what was in the room, what was said in the room, and we would at the end come up with a forecast versus, you know, kind of what the reality turned out to be, you would have never made money. What these guys then did after all that great talking, they thought about mispricings in particular assets where they had an edge, maybe mortgage-backed securities or credit, maybe because they had an edge of understanding where they can source liquidity cheaply. And they took maybe a little bit, a fraction of this, but used their edge in making money in the product. So making kind of big bets, realize that you're gonna be influenced by the crowd. You're human. You wanna be, you know, it's very uncomfortable for anyone to be outside of the crowd on a judgment, because at some point you'll start questioning yourself, am I wrong? Yep.
So it's more like a personal question.
Sure.
But is it hard for women to work in finance?
Yeah. Question is it hard for women to be, I was the only mother in Everest Base Camp. Is it hard for me to be in Everest Camp, Base Camp and be a mother? It's always hard to be different, right? It's always hard to be one. And you just have, you cannot be defensive. You cannot be sensitive in terms of, you know, people asking questions or people treating you. Just have to understand your social curiosity. But over time, that will change. So the best way of, I think, performing in this type of environment is becoming a part of the culture and changing culture from within. Or as, you know, you may not like her, but Sheryl Sandberg's term, leaning in and making the environment you help, you know, really, really, really help. So it's, you know, it's not easy. You can always kind of find where your difference is and try to fight it. Or you could say, I'm going to leverage the best of this culture and make it my aid and, you know, try to thrive in that environment. Again, clearly don't join the outfits that are explicitly misogynistic, but now it's illegal, right? So find your manners. I always think like it's important to have your own board of directors, say people who help you, who, you know, advise you on career moves, transitions, success. You're bound when you join any firm in your first couple of years, you're bound to be incredibly anxious and insecure about your progress. I remember sitting down with my manager, I don't know, after two months, I finished graduate school and came to work at Goldman's, and I was like, how am I doing? And he was like, well, I frankly didn't have a chance to get to know you, right? But it's you know, your level of anxiety about your performance could be just outsized relative to, you know, actually the need of that, right? And it's absolutely normal. So keep, like my big career giveaway for you would be just be patient with progression. Progression takes time. It takes time, particularly in this, like in this business, your value of an analyst or portfolio manager comes with judgment, and you can only hone judgment over time by making mistakes, right? Good judgment comes, just like in the mountains, this comes from experiencing things and turning away and having, you know, experiencing bad things and learning and then kind of not repeating that mistake. So just have patience and things will come. And don't jump sheep unless it's, don't try to, you know, like I've seen the payoffs, huge payoffs coming from staying at Goldman for 12 years, right? And I could have switched firms, I could have gone, you know, after 4 years to someone who paid me a bit more, but staying in, leaning in, learning the culture, excelling at that, provided again the environment suits you, is probably the best way of achieving longer term success and being happy.
So Warren Buffett says that derivatives are financial weapons of mass destruction, but they are actually meant for hedging investors' risk. So what is your take on that? What do you have to say on that?
Huh. Great question. So when I studied, I'm a dinosaur, I studied in 96 to 98. I don't know if you guys, any of you go to Oxford Said School. We have the dean, new dean there, Peter Tufano. He taught me, I took a bunch of classes at Harvard Business School. He taught corporate financial engineering, and he had about three case studies, Harvard teaches cases, on Enron. Enron was all the rage, right, in 98. In fact, I had the privilege of having an offer letter, not only from Goldman Sachs, but also from Enron, because it was at that point the great employer, and it was the firm to work for. And they are extreme case to show how extension, I mean, why did the HBS professors love Enron? Because they showed how derivatives can take off the risk, expand your balance sheet, and create financial capacity for taking so much more risk and becoming so much bigger firm, right? So anything in the right proportion is probably okay. You need to understand what you're using derivative for. Paying for insurance, fat tail insurance, is probably not worth it, right? And that's what Gross demonstrated to you by saying that selling volatility every time, you know, over to, like not doing it, how to say, sporadically, but doing it consistently, will make you money. But you could have certain requirements as a corporate where you have to hedge your currency back because you have obligations, right? Or so if you're using derivatives to square your balance sheet and not to have a big mismatch of FX liabilities, that's where it makes sense. If you're doing it to do something creative and construct kind of limitless growth possibilities by, you know, offloading risk or, you know, by, you think, de-risking the mortgage continuum through whatever tranches, right, you then get the point of mispriced capital across the market, which is what happened in 2008, right, where everyone could afford the mortgage, but really they didn't, right? So it has to be, I think derivatives have to be used for the specific, they have application, but again, think of how much you're paying for these odds. And remember, derivatives, we used fat tail protection for some of our portfolios. The problem, the trouble is that derivatives have finite life. So you think you're going to need a certain option, and you may need that certain option that may pay off, but it may expire 3 months before you actually the event occurs. So unfortunately, the time value of money, the time decay in options is extraordinarily aggressive. So unless you were lucky to realize that probability early on in the option, it's almost, it's very, very difficult to make money. Yeah.
Hi. So you previously said that you believe that there is another internet bubble. So in case that this were to be true and it happened, how could someone like or oneself get like profitable from that situation?
Well, you can profit from the situation by not owning the stocks. you need to kind of understand where is, and again, I've been out of investing for now 2 years, so I cannot tell you whether S&P valuations outside of, let's say, or NASDAQ valuations outside of those companies are extraordinarily stretched, so I can't tell you that. It's very difficult to make money out of shorting because, as I explained to you, the probability of these events, unwinding events, tend to happen much further down the line. So what's the best way of protecting this is owning boring companies that no one wants to buy, right? So the time when growth gets overvalued, it's best to buy, to be honest, like British American Tobacco and stick with a company that gives you 4% yield and is likely to give you probably 8 to 10% capital appreciation because of the exposure to emerging markets they've had where the tobacco usage is still going up. And you are likely, again, for that type of company, you know, in the market environment where growth is at a premium, you're likely, again, to have then the, the flow funds of out of this young bright stars towards the companies that are not that valued. The other one is obviously sticking with large companies where, let's say Google, right, went, again, I won't comment on valuation of Google today, right, but this is a company where, you know, you were surprised with earning bits over time because they are the market leader. So if you are the market leader, if you continue investing in innovation, these companies are likely then to be able to buy some of the companies that may go bust or may not have liquidity available to them to grow at the time when this bubble bursts and become beneficiaries of that. So being more conservative at the time when the others are overly optimistic. Yep.
Let me just, sorry, interrupt. Let's take another couple of questions, and then you're all welcome to a reception upstairs on the fifth floor of this building. And we can continue chatting with Masha for a while up there. Okay, so let's go on for a while longer.
Some of the best financial engineers like Emanuel Derman and Fisher Black, who actually developed the Black-Scholes model, came from Goldman Sachs. So I was wondering if you had any experience working with quants and if you had any opinions on quantitative strategies in trading today.
Sure. So Goldman Sachs Asset Management had a terrific quant franchise. In fact, the former colleagues of Myron Black and Scholes, the guy called Bob Litterman, who is another great manager, he worked in that franchise. What blew up quants, and that franchise used to be, and I'll tell you about why things get missold, it used to be maybe $50 billion at a height, and it was very profitable for Goldman's because they were charging performance fees. You know, you had years when the quants delivered, and again, they were very, quants is about process, right? They're very unemotional. You have bazillion, you know, strategies in the portfolio, and it's higher frequency trading, and you are trying to exploit quantitatively. You're eliminating the human factor. You're exploiting quantitatively a rule. This works beautifully until it doesn't. And in 2007, there were too many quantum managers effectively trying to go after the same market inefficiency, and they weren't fast enough. So that particular franchise got completely obliterated because, A, it returned very negative returns of minus 40% in 1 year. No one asked, by the way, how did they make 50% in a year before. But minus 40%, it was missold as kind of a foolproof, low volatility product. It still, and Goldman fired half of these people or they left, which was a huge mistake. Again, they were super talented. You missold the product, and you should, as an institution, carry the brunt of that. But they were probably, you know, if I had to put up the picture of the guys outside of this great giants who made it, these were the quant managers who went on and created their own firms. What was the problem? The problem was when they were making 50% return, no one looked at the fact that the volatility of an underlying product was 25%. And they went on and sold that product to, I don't know, Dutch pension authority or like Dutch pharmacy union. These people have no business of owning that in such a proportion, right? Because when the volatility is 25%, the three standard deviation event is what? Times two, right, at least. So your negative returns could be minus 40, right? How do you make, you can't make 50% with a volatility of 5%, right? You have to be incredibly lucky in one particular call. If you have a diversified funds of that sort, you know, it's a high vol funds. So who can buy them? Probably only high net worth individuals, not institutions, right? You should be a qualified high net worth who says, you know, this is a fraction of my wealth, I'm happy to have it. Or as a qualified institutional buyer, you may be able to allocate 5% of your portfolio to higher risk option. Because again, the probability of you losing with that volatility, losing in large and absolute amounts is high as well. So I have huge respect for quants, but you need to also understand their models are culpable to the group thing, so to speak. They all can find the same market inefficiency, go for the same, try to arbitrage it away, and then liquidity seized. So you're all trying to go for the same trade, then you're trying to unwind it, right, because you understand it's not working, because price momentum is one of the biggest factors that quants use. So once the market starts going against you, you have a negative price momentum, you sell, and that's where you counter the human behavior. But if the market sees on you and you don't have liquidity, you're bust. Because by the time you sell, you have effectively bagged those negative returns. Yeah.
Well, with the recent developments in the markets, like the Brexit and other important news, do you think outliers in the financial markets have a better role or a greater role to play?
Yeah, but it's like we're humans, you know? Like, look at political history. The dramas that were in Rome, you know, are repeating themselves in British politics, right? We're humans. So I think it's very difficult to remain and be an outlier because it requires being an autistic spectrum. It requires this insensitivity to, you know, to social pressure, insensitivity to the way you come across in your image. And again, the only way how you can remain that is by effectively closeting yourself, I'm a value investor. Like you need to have some tenet of saying, people are telling me I'm wrong, but I know I'm right, and how do you, like, you need to have some blanket of a process or something, some fig leaf to wrap around yourself. But again, being an outlier consistently, is almost impossible. Okay, last question, yeah.
I work as a financial regulator in Japan. So mm-hmm. If you have some comment or advice to the world financial regulator, I want to ask from you.
Can you repeat the advice on what, sorry?
Advice or comment or criticize to the world regulator. So I want to ask this time.
What should be done by financial leader? Sorry.
Yes. So.
Okay. So I think we've had a repair of the balance of power between the regulator and the big banks. And I think that I do think that the rules of the way we pay bankers and pay asset managers are changing. They're changing for the better because we're trying to change the reward for luck for taking outsized bets, then, you know, at the end of the day, bring down the world and waste taxpayers' pay. So I think that addressing the compensation rules, addressing the rules of how transparency for the savers is extremely important. Clearly, we need to be able to pay people in the government and regulatory bodies well enough to keep the talent that has both IQ and vigilance to be able to put it through, and that's a dilemma, right? Because when you have this big clash between the Wall Street and war for talent and the regulator, you need to have competent people, you know, sitting on both sides, because I know how if the competence is not there, you could get, you know, smashed. We have, interestingly, similar dilemma now, I think, in the UK. We're trying to negotiate and extricate ourselves out of European Union, and we apparently have only 20 trade negotiators because trade negotiation was not a part of our life, right? We were a part of the different construct. So the notion that 20 UK trade negotiators from the government will be negotiating against 400 people in European Commission that know the rules inside out and be successful at getting us advantageous rules is simply silly, right? So it's kind of having that balance of talent, you know, that could address, you know, inadequacies of the financial system is very, very important. So thank you very, very much for your time, guys.
Thank you again, Masha, for your insights during your presentation and for sharing your experience here. Please accept a small gift from the LSE Summer School on behalf of all of us.